Welcome to this first breakout session. Here in this room, this is geared mostly to ministers. If you have a role in ministering to people on a religious basis, this is where you're in the right spot. And this will be very informative. I know the members of the panel and the moderator very well, and I'm excited to hear their messages. Stephen Bangeter is going to be our moderator, and he's recognized by the American Society of Legal Advocates as one of the top 100 litigation lawyers in the state of Utah. He's a founding partner of Bangeter, Shepherd, and Frazier PC, and he has represented nonprofit organizations, including churches, schools, and universities throughout the Western United States for over 20 years. He also serves as a stake president in the St. George Washington Field Stake, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and has had many years of experience ministering to those needs of individuals and families. I'm going to turn the mic over to him, and I'm going to let him introduce the panel. President Bangeter.
Thank you. Thank you. We welcome you this morning. We're pleased to have you here. I'm actually surprised to see so many in this particular session because of the specialized nature of our topic, but we're grateful to have you here. The topic for this panel discussion is Guiding Spiritual Healing, Ministering to Those Affected by Pornography. I'd like to briefly begin by introducing our panelists this morning. Seated directly to my right is Daniel Weiss. Daniel traveled all the way from Wisconsin to be with us. Grateful to have him here. In fact, he got in last night at 11:30 because of delays with his mode of transportation. So we're grateful to have him here. He said, "That's not so bad." I was concerned about his lack of rest. He said, "That's not so bad. I have 5 children." So he's on top of his game this morning. He's the founder and the president of Brushfires Foundation. Brushfires is a foundation and outreach created to tackle tough questions about sexual identity with depth and compassion. He has written for the Washington Times and others. He's presented at Capitol Hill Summit on Pornography in Washington, D.C., and was a senior analyst for media and sexuality with focus on the family. Susan Green, I don't need to tell you, I hope I don't need to tell you which one is Susan Green. She's a mother of 9 remarkable children and therefore the most qualified panelist here. She works as a teacher and is currently serving in her 6th year as a Stake Relief Society president for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Seated at the end is Chris Bracken. He is the father of 6 children. He's founder of AAA Disaster Service Master Restore and works with his wife, Karina, as a wellness advocate with doTERRA. Bishop Bracken also serves as a bishop in the LDS Church. Norm Tebow joins us as a panelist. He is a father of 4 children and holds a PhD in marriage and family therapy. He is the founder and director of 3 Points Academy, a residential treatment center for adopted adolescents and their families. Dr. Tebow also currently serves as a bishop in the LDS Church. We have a few questions that we prepared that we hope will be poignant and insightful for you to get things rolling this morning. Then we may open it up to a few questions from the body of the congregation here. So we'll begin, Daniel, with you. In our society today, we face many challenges, particularly in our ministries in religious organizations. And Daniel, the question for you is, oftentimes church leaders will find it difficult or they'll be reluctant, or even church members, to address matters of sexuality in the church. What counsel do you have for us with regard to that challenge?
Oh, thank you, President. I do think that in the work I've done over the, not just with Brushfires, but at Focus on the Family, that matters of sexuality, they touch us so deeply. They go to the deep of our core person. And I think, as we saw in the last presentation, there's a great deal of spiritual, a great spiritual nature as part of our being. So I would say naturally, it's a natural fit for spiritual leaders to be talking about these things, but because I think so many of us feel a sense of brokenness in our own lives, it's very difficult for us to talk about those things because it involves exposing ourselves and making ourselves vulnerable. I think this is true for spiritual leaders as well. I'm not meaning to suggest every spiritual leader is struggling with some kind of hidden sin. I don't mean it that way. But often in the ways that Lexi and Lindsay told us, we're in a society that has made all of these topics shameful and embarrassing. And so it's very difficult, I think, for spiritual leaders to overcome this kind of social push to keep these things contained, hidden, and silent. So, you know, my advice, and when I speak with spiritual leaders, pastors, Catholic priests, and others, is the biggest thing is to get over that sense of fear, because what I think we'll find on the other side of that fear is a sense of relief and freedom that we never knew was possible. And I'll give one example from my own life, and then I'll stop. But I had a situation of brokenness in my life when I was younger, and I dealt with it and came to resolution and healing and forgiveness, but I put it up in the back corner of my life, put it up in the closet, all tied up in a little box. It was really contained. And then something inspired me to share that with a friend. And the freedom that I felt for revealing a part of myself that I had locked away, even though it had already been handled, was such an incredible relief for me. I decided to share it with my men's group. And all these men started opening up about their own brokenness. They all felt so bound up. And I think as spiritual leaders, this is really a path forward, is if we can become honest and open about these things, we're going to find there are others that want to share this as well. And then we don't feel isolated. We become community.
Thank you. Other thoughts? You know, it strikes me that it's not only a sense of discomfort that we as leaders, church leaders or shepherds of those that we love so much, it's also getting over the initial hurdle of the concern or the fear, the shame that those who come to us seeking assistance have. That initial meeting, those initial steps that are taken with them are critical for them to feel our love and our acceptance, for them to feel that while this may be an awkward topic to begin with, it's something, the speaking of it, the opening up about it, becomes something that becomes fundamental. It is foundational to progress that's going to be made. Have you seen that? We've got a couple of bishops here. Have you seen that? Do you achieve more success when there's a level of comfort that's established early on?
I think definitely. I think one of the things that it does is it gives everybody permission to talk about it. And once we have that permission, it reduces the anxiety in talking about it. I think one of the problems that perhaps we struggle with as ecclesiastical leaders is feeling like, okay, I've got to say the right thing right now to fix this for this person. And as a therapist or as a bishop, ultimately at the end of the day, I have to be careful about taking that on because it's not my problem to solve. It's my problem to love, to assist, support, and guide. I don't have to fix it. And once I can alleviate myself or disabuse myself of that notion, then it makes it easier to talk about and realize we're in this together, and I'm gonna help you to the best of my ability as guided by inspiration. And we're gonna work on this together and talk about it openly because this is important.
Thank you. Chris, let's move to you and shift lanes just a little bit, but will you share with us how you, as a church leader, how all of us who minister to those who face and are fighting these challenges, will you help us understand how you distinguish those who may have a greater challenge that may even rise to the level of an addiction versus those who are struggling with a bad habit that's not yet risen to that level?
Yes, thank you. Inherently, pornography is very addictive. However, not all users of pornography are addicts. And so as a church leader, it becomes very important that we distinguish the difference between a serious addiction and maybe a habit. And I believe this can be achieved by asking a series of questions. And some of these questions we could ask is, when did you start using pornography? And if we're dealing with somebody that's in their 20s or 30s or 40s, and they've had an issue with pornography since their early teens, we begin to understand that they've been dealing with this addiction for more than half their life. And we're better able to understand how to direct them and how to help them in their recovery. Some other questions we might want to ask them is, how often and how long do you view pornography? We also might want to ask them is, what effects have pornography had in your life as well? And I believe by asking these questions, it becomes easier as a church leader to distinguish whether it's a serious addiction or whether it's a habit.
Norm, if I may return to you on that question, can a person be an addict and yet go for months without participating in the viewing of pornography?
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you ferret out? Where do you go with individuals, as Bishop Bracken had discussed, who have faced pornography and its challenges for years, yet they go for long periods of time without viewing?
Part of that is, Steve, is looking at the big picture, which is, what is the pattern in your life, and how does this continue to show up on a much larger pattern? We want to acknowledge and reinforce those periods of abstinence, but we also need to not assume that just because there's a period of dryness, if you will, that doesn't mean that the problem is, quote unquote, resolved. That period of abstinence might be part of a larger pattern. And without intervention and appropriate treatment, will just repeat itself. One of the things that we look at to determine whether it's a habit versus something more significant is, there's a term we use in the field as a therapist, clinically significant. To what extent is this interfering with your life at a number of levels? Is it interfering spiritually? Is it interfering emotionally? Do you have distress as a result of this? And so part of it is just taking a look at the feedback that the person is creating in their life because of these behaviors. Do you come away from this feeling good about yourself? Well, then that's significant. And so it's not necessarily about time, because these things can take an extreme amount of time to work through. It's more about change in attitude, behavior, emotionality around the problem.
All right, thank you. Oftentimes we see, for example, men come in and they've carried this burden for a long time. Oftentimes they've spoken to church leaders in the past, received some counsel here or there, followed it. It may have worked for a short time, a few weeks or months, sometimes even years, and then they have backtracked and fallen back into it. All the time, though, keeping it hidden, keeping it secret, and desperate that their wives not find out. Usually not only because of the embarrassment that it will bring to them, but often even more so because of the pain they feel that it will bring to their wife, to their spouse, or to their children. Susan, how can church leaders effectively deal with those situations? How would you recommend that we minister to the spouse of the addicted?
Well, you know, I think we need to realize that for the spouse of a pornography addict, it feels a lot to them like their family has just disintegrated. One sister told me it was like going down the highway in a car with her family and being hit, and everyone lost their life except her. In other words, the family was that broken. And I think we need to realize that there's an immense grieving process that takes place at that point. And we have to figure out as leaders how to help them grieve and be patient while they do that. And that means mourning with them. It means being frequently connected to them and being good listeners. Had lots of women tell me I needed a listening ear more than I needed advice and counsel at the beginning. I think we need to be really sensitive to the amount of shame that they feel, and that was talked about this morning very well, and try to do all we can as ministers to eradicate that shame or help them deal with that shame and overcome that. I think it's important that those spouses of pornography addicts get equal access to counsel from their clergy and also from a good therapist. I think sometimes we think, well, that the person with the addiction needs the help. Well, the spouse, the family need help as well. Daniel kind of commented on this a minute ago. I think it's important for us in our congregations to try to make our congregations safe places, places where they can still come when they're suffering and not feel worse for being there. We need to live transparent lives so that they can feel safety in being among us. And I also feel it's very valuable for men and women leaders to counsel together to try to stabilize the influence that something like this has on a family.
Chris?
If I could just add to that, as a bishop, I'm so grateful for the additional support I receive from the leaders in our ward, both female and male leaders. It not only is very helpful in the recovery process, but it's also very helpful to receive support as a bishop as well.
This notion of transparency, of bringing the issue out, of making it known to the spouse is critical. It's been fundamental in every case that I've seen where any modicum of success has been achieved. And bringing the spouse in, after getting through that initial stage, what are the next steps? How do you continue forward? What do you do with that? Daniel, I'll put that to you.
Well, I think I'll wrap in something that was just mentioned, the idea of the ward leaders contributing to the healing. I think that's a real key part of this, and especially ongoing, because what that communicates is that you've got a community of care. You're not isolating either the addict or the spouse, or you're not isolating the couple into some secret form of therapy or healing. You've involved other leaders. You've involved the larger community. I think that's really important for the folks in recovery to sense there's a wider community of help. There's a wider community of support and love. I think moving on, through that disclosure, through that that grief and grieving process into a longer-term care is certainly going to involve that wider community.
Thank you. Norm, I'll posit this to you. As church leaders, we are oftentimes limited in our expertise. Rarely are we professionally trained in these areas. We've not been to colleges and universities and learned methods of counseling and therapy. We go online and we try to learn what we can, but oftentimes it's necessary to include professionals to assist us. How do we make that determination, and how do we proceed to make that occur?
Well, there's a few different things you'd want to do in taking a look at the pattern of the pornography abuse. What kind of history? How long has the person looked at abuse extensively? How many ecclesiastical leaders has this person tried to work through it with? How varied are the items they've looked at? A lot of different factors that would enable you to decide this is an ongoing, pervasive, and persistent issue that's out of my scope. I think one thing that's important, if an issue is significant enough to present to a professional, to refer that someone, that one of your sheep, if you will, if you're a shepherd and you're referring them to a professional that you would trust, obviously, then trust the professional. Speaking as both an ecclesiastical leader and a professional in mental health counseling, I once had a situation where I received a phone call from an ecclesiastical leader in a referral, and he said, I'm going to refer someone from my congregation to you, and this was for an affair, and we have three sessions. I can't do a whole lot with three sessions, but my hands were somewhat tied by the ecclesiastical leader, so on one hand, I think ecclesiastical leaders, if we are going to trust a professional to work with those people in our congregation, we need to be very, very trusting and allow them to do the appropriate assessment and work that they need to do. On the other hand, it's a collaborative relationship. Releases need to be signed, and those ecclesiastical leaders, we need to be able to communicate with the therapist to understand what the goals are, what the realistic expectations are for the length of treatment, and have a continuing ongoing dialogue. I believe ecclesiastical leaders, although not trained in mental health counseling, can provide significant insight into the dynamics of the family and other important variables that mental health counselors need to consider. Further, I think the mental health counselor should not just assume that things are handed off. I think the counselor needs to be able to work closely with an ecclesiastical leader to make them aware of what's going on and to ask for input and counsel as to how they're showing up and what the family dynamic is like. I think it's a supportive relationship, none more important than the other.
A couple of important facts, a couple of important points to highlight there. One is there's a privilege enjoyed by these individuals and their therapists on the one hand, and on the other, the privilege that the penitent has with the clergy. So to you pastors who are here, bishops, other ecclesiastical leaders that join us today, keep those two privileges in mind as you begin to discuss individuals and their specific circumstances with a therapist. You've got to first have an unequivocal granting of permission from those you're counseling with, and that same permission needs to be given to the therapist. Once that occurs, if you can establish a strong line of communication where you have a regular reporting back and forth to one another, it helps so that the right hand knows what the left is doing and so that all ends are not being played against the middle. That clear level of information is absolutely critical. Bishop Bracken, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah.
Tell us about your interaction with therapists in your ecclesiastical role. What does it look like?
It's very helpful. Once I feel like there's a serious addiction, I will refer the user to a therapist. And once that begins, it's nice to have an open line of communication between the therapist and the church leader. And what I find is that the therapist is so much more educated and understands these issues than I, that we work together and the recovery progress helps. I mean, it just really progresses well when I've had that experience to work with a counselor.
From time to time, we face challenging situations. You've noticed today here with us today, we have a number of youth. There is a breakout session directed to youth that's occurring right now. Oftentimes, challenges arise within congregations. I've had members of our church come to me and indicate that they felt that on this occasion or on that occasion, a church leader was perhaps too blunt, insensitive, shared information in a setting where their child was present that they felt was within the purview of the family, not the church. Daniel, if I could direct this to you, are there appropriate ways for a pastor or leader to approach these topics without singling people out, without offending, without going too far in the church setting,
right,
that's, religious context?
That's a great question. I think that goes to the first question you posed. What are some of the reasons that leaders might be hesitant? I think getting that kind of feedback is very difficult because a spiritual leader wants to balance the needs of the congregation. Certainly no one in a leadership position, or I presume no one really is out there to cause harm or cause offense. Nevertheless, that happens. And again, because these issues are so difficult, I find that it's helpful to, like if you were to mention the word sex publicly, people's minds automatically are gonna go to somewhere. Oftentimes, they're gonna go to what they know, and a lot of us have been evangelized by the culture. So it takes us to a place in our mind we might not want to go, and then we're upset that someone sprung that on us. I think for spiritual leaders, what I like to encourage, if you're going to talk about sensitive issues, try to help it's helpful to remove the context from people's behavior into their identity. So if we talk about in the beginning of the Bible, God made male and female in his image and his likeness, we see that there's an identity there that we can talk about. We can talk about the value of male. We can talk about the value of female. We can talk about the beauty of marriage. We can talk about the beauty of family, all in ways that are talking about our identity, our created identity. And I think we can start to talk about difficult issues at that level that's more of a conceptual or an identity level, a spiritual level, rather than going down to the behavior level, which is where people sometimes, you know, you run into problems because it starts people thinking or kids start asking questions. On the same token, I think we don't want to single people out who are struggling with issues to make it so as the sermon or the message we're giving is all about you. It's just about you, and that person feels very singled out. So I think I encourage people to talk about brokenness is something we all struggle with. It's part of human life. And so if we can start to talk about brokenness or wounds that we've all felt, they don't always have to be sexual wounds, they can be relational wounds, all different kinds of struggles we have in life, we make it safer, as Susan said, we make it safer to talk about these issues, and then we can be in a more general sense in the public setting or the congregational setting, but we make sure that people understand it's okay to come to me privately. You're free to do that, and we encourage that.
Thank you. Other thoughts? You know you've nailed it, Daniel, when there are no other thoughts. I think all of us would agree, regardless of the religious tradition from which we come, that parents have a divine stewardship, a responsibility to guide our children. When advising, Susan, if I may, go to you with this. When advising a young single person who is struggling with pornography, how can we as parents become more involved in supporting them? We all experience we see those advertisements on television, and the parents try to talk to their children, and the attempt is lame. How are you doing? Fine. Good. Well, have a good night's sleep. And it ends there. Share with us some thoughts, if you would, about how parents can be more involved in supporting their children, understanding their lives, and what's taking place in these private times of their lives.
I think the answer to this is so important. You were just talking about, youth in a situation where their church leaders have to feel like they have to talk to them about these things, and parents come forward and they're upset about it. That kind of tells us that parents aren't possibly really doing their job. And I know I've had a church leader out our way say to me, we have got to get our parents on the same page because we're seeing behaviors in their children they have no idea about. And so as parents, we have got to find the courage to really talk to our children about these things in ways that they understand and in ways that are safe. I think we could do a lot in our congregations, in our women's groups, in our our elders' quorums, those kinds of places to help each other understand how to do that better. But we've got to convince our parents and exemplify it ourselves that we have the courage to talk to our children about sexuality and about morality and to be checking their phones and to be checking every aspect of their life so that we really know what they're involved in. And then we can go to our church leaders and ask for help. I feel strongly about the responsibility that parents have to do this, and it's devastating when they don't. But I think as we talk about it amongst our groups, we can empower each other to do a better job of this.
Bishop Bracken, how have you done that in your congregation? How have you reached out to the parents and the youth in an attempt to enhance the relationship between them vis-a-vis pornography and topic matters of addiction?
I brought all the parents together.
Pull that mic.
And had a discussion regarding pornography. and let them know how intrusive it is and how common it is. I think some of the parents were a little shocked when I shared with them some numbers of some studies of the number of youth that are using pornography. So I brought them together, and I let them know that as a bishop, as I sit in an interview with their children, and we discuss chastity and the law of chastity, a lot of these children don't understand and don't know what the law of chastity is. And as a bishop, I'm finding myself as the individual in their life that's teaching them, that helping them understand what pornography is. And I do. I believe the parents have a role to educate their children regarding these things. And if they don't, they're going to hear it from someone else other than a parent or a church leader. And that's not always the best way to receive that information.
Thank you. Daniel, I saw you nodding your head. Did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. I have a friend who's also a marriage and family therapist, and he taught me something that I think is really helpful for parents. He said, it's important to teach from the good, the true, and the beautiful. We start with what's good and holy, and then we explain the deviations. So we start with what we're made for, but then we can explain the deviations and the distortions of the world. So I think even before we talk about pornography, which I totally agree is very essential in today's world, hopefully, and you can start this at any time, but hopefully you'll have laid the groundwork even from very early on, even bathing our children, talking about their bodies and talking about health. That's a health and safety and cleanliness. So we understand the proper use of the body. As they get older and some of the questions of sexuality start, we've already laid a groundwork of what's good, what's right, what's holy, what's beautiful. Then we can say, look at that commercial, or what did your friends say at school today? Does that really align with what you know to be true? No, it doesn't. And so we're helping them. Again, the message earlier was teasing through the media messages. I think we need to tease through and help our children identify those harmful messages. But we do that by promoting the good and strengthening the good so that they're better able to recognize and resist the brokenness that frankly is all around us.
Thank you. Perhaps we could go to you. There must be certain individuals out there who have burning questions you'd like to put to the panel. Yes, thank you. I'm going to. Let's go to Norm.
The question is how to. Oh, I was just going to say that the question is, how do you deal with an issue without planting the seed of curiosity? And I think in this issue, I let me relate it to something else. There was that thought when we talked about suicidality with some of our clients and therapists, and what the research has shown that by broaching the topic, it does not necessarily plant the seed of curiosity at all. It frees us up to talk about it and actually releases anxiety and reduces the likelihood that they're going to engage in those kind of behaviors. And I would say that's the same thing with pornography. It's out there. It's prevalent. Usually, if we're talking to someone about it as an ecclesiastical leader, we're behind the curve and they've already explored something with it. And so our task is not to shy from that or worry about planting seeds of curiosity, but to go ahead and embrace the fact that it's there and it's a reality that we need to face.
You know, if I might share my thoughts on that, if I may, if I could give you an example from my own life, the greatest minister I ever knew was my father. As a very young boy, before I knew what pornography was, my father visited with me on many occasions regarding the beauty God, our Heavenly Father, had put in his daughters. I recall at a very young age, my father taking me through scriptures, particularly those of the Old Testament, where God's feelings for his created daughters on this earth is clearly defined. I remember my father then teaching me the relationship between how God thinks of his daughters and how we feel when we look at things that are inappropriate relate to one another. There is inherent within all of us an indicator that causes a certain level of discomfort to arise within us when we see things that we shouldn't be seeing. This great minister, my father, taught me to understand what that feeling meant when it rose up within me. I did see pornography, and every time I saw it, and to this day when I do, and including many things that the world wouldn't define as pornography, when I feel those feelings, I remember what I was taught about how God wants us to feel, and therefore put this indicator within us versus how I feel when I look at those things. Because of that, I think I was able to train myself at a young age to act on those indicators. Back there in the blue plaid shirt. Yes, thank you. Excellent, thank you. The question is, what answers to the questions phrased earlier, to questions directed at bringing out whether behavior is an addiction or behavior is a bad habit or just a bad reoccurring practice? What kind of answers connote addiction versus a bad habit, reoccurring bad acts?
You know, I think that's a difficult question to answer in general, simply because everyone is different and there's so many variables that can be involved in that. If I may, I would go back to the idea that how is it showing up in their lives? What kind of distress is this creating for the person? Now, having said that, I realize that some people don't see a problem with it and won't acknowledge the distress. That's a different issue when we talk about systemically how is it impacting the people around them. And so at some degree, it's to what extent is it interfering with daily tasks, with their life, with the way they feel about themselves, with relationships with significant others. And if it's continuing, despite having knowledge of problems it's creating, then that's more than just a habit.
She's a missionary in the addiction recovery program, particularly relating to spousal support. You're doing great. What is the church doing to empower sisters to rely on the spirit they're feeling? She indicates that she sees a dichotomy between what they're being taught through LDS church materials, which encourage those participating in the addiction recovery program to rely on whisperings of the spirit to guide their paths in determining what they're going to do. She gave an example, what they're going to do with their marriage, versus what the church is counseling. In other words, she sees on occasion a difference between what the sisters are, in her example, the sisters are feeling from the spirit and what they're being counseled by their bishops to do. Bishop Bracken, let's put that one to you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Bishop.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Bishop.
I believe as bishops, we're counseled for members to draw conclusions from themselves, and we don't necessarily give them the advice on whether to divorce or whether to stay with their spouse. We're taught to teach them gospel principles and allow them to make decisions for themselves.
It's the notion that flows from being agents to ourselves, and it's not, though perhaps the uncareful mind might think that to be a cop-out. It's based on a fundamental principle. Your question flows from the LDS doctrine. It flows from a fundamental principle in the LDS doctrine that we are agents unto ourselves. And so to have a shepherd is different than to have a herder. And so bishops counsel ought to be consistent with the counsel that is being provided in the materials that you're utilizing and relying upon. Sometimes I'll tell you, our counsel as church leaders may not be exactly what you're hearing it to be. I think that for your position, rather than to question the counsel that we have given or that you're hearing from this person we've given, it would be for you to request permission to visit with their ecclesiastical leader. It's certainly appropriate. It's no different in my mind than a therapist and a bishop counseling together to make sure that they're on the same page. But in addition, if the bishops are adhering to the general handbooks of instruction and the scriptures, and to the Spirit, they're going to be providing the same counsel you are. And when there's a difference, then you can come together to discuss that, and there's no offense in that. Others, back in the back. You're going to have to be really loud.
That's an excellent question. And the question is, if you have someone who comes into an ecclesiastical leader who confesses pornography addiction but chooses to not, does not want that disclosed to the spouse for fear that the spouse might leave or create more distress for the spouse, how would you handle that? And I think it's a very real question. I've seen that happen in my own congregation. And I have a very specific step-by-step process wherein I ask the perpetrator to please kneel down with me, and then I take out the scriptures and I bonk them over the head with them. Just kidding.
Some of the views expressed by this panel do not necessarily represent the views of all who are participating on this panel.
What I do in a love, in a spirit of love and compassion, is what I call a carefrontation. It's not a confrontation, but it's a carefrontation, and it involves being led by the Spirit, but also, and also, teaching. We don't exist in vacuums. No one has a pornography addiction that does not impact someone else. And so a good portion of our task as ecclesiastical leaders is helping that member to understand the importance of how this is impacting other people, and that this is not something that exists in a vacuum. That helping them understand the selfishness that's involved, how it changes the brain, how it changes relationships, and that this is an offense to everyone within the family. It's not an isolated thing. And part of our task is to do that with love. And I can respect the idea of not wanting to hurt a spouse. It's interesting. I was listening to a Dr. Laura show some years ago, and she encouraged people to not disclose these type of things to their spouses, because she said, why put the burden on them when you're the one doing it? And I think it showed a fundamental lack of understanding of the damage of pornography abuse. So we love the person. We work with them in laying out a plan for disclosing to the spouse, but it must be disclosed to the spouse. And it's got to be on their terms. We have to honor our obligation of confidentiality. But true change, as we talk about, true change is not happening without that disclosure. I don't believe that it would.
Thank you. I'm being given the red light. In fact, it's flaming red now that we're over our time. I'd like to express our appreciation to the panelists today and encourage you to stick around for the keynote address that will be given later by Daniel Weiss, who we're so grateful to have with us. Thank you.